The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
There's a yellow sheet I passed out. You can pass them across now. There's also about, if you're in the back row, some of them are white. They ran some extras off. But the sheet will say, using questions for maximum learning. Our topic in this hour is asking effective questions. A question is an interesting sentence. We have declarative sentences that make statements, and we have imperative sentences that tell somebody to do something. And then we have interrogative sentences that end with a bit of a raise of voice, and it raises a question in the other person's mind. It doesn't impart information, doesn't tell them to do something. It leaves the other person hanging. He has to respond somehow. Well, asking and answering questions, that's very much what teaching involves. If we don't have a question, we're really not going to learn anything, are we? We have to wonder about something. We have to be unsure about something before we have a question. Now, there are many things that you don't know and that I don't know. There's much, much more that I don't know than that I do, obviously, with all of us. And there are many things I don't wonder about. I really don't care. I've said that in relation already to the internet. This information age, you're supposed to be able to know everything about everything. I said, I really don't care what the blood pressure is of the vice president of Ghana right now. And if I could find that information out with one click of the mouse, I don't think I'd click the mouse. I don't wonder. And so, I think that's all right. There's more I don't wonder about than I do wonder about. But if we don't wonder about anything, we don't learn anything. And so we have to wonder about the proper things. Much of what we are is a result of the questions we did or did not ask and the kind of answers we received. Now, we can also say that much of what we're missing is a result of inaccurate answers we received or questions that we never asked. When a question is asked, there's a variety of reasons why it's asked. And one of the major things to think, recall as a teacher, is that we want to ask questions in such a way that stimulate thinking, that do give some answers, but if the answer to a question stops all future thinking on that subject, well then, in a sense, we've done a disservice to the person that asked the question. There are many motives for asking a question. Sometimes the person asks the question and he simply wants to know an answer so he can fill in the blanks, so this is done, then I can get on with something else. That person really doesn't care what the answer to the question is. What he wants to know is what I should put in this blank so I can get on with life. And then that's out of the way. Well, that's really not a very good question, is it? And questions stimulate us to think. Questions stimulate us to read. Questions stimulate us to calculate, to study, to observe, to converse. I suspect that it was questions that brought you here. I wonder. What will be said? I wonder if there will be anything useful, whatever. If we're not curious about something, we don't go to see what's around the next corner. When you see somebody walking at the corner to check what's around the corner, he really has a question. What's around that corner? When somebody opens up a book and looks in the book, he really has a question. What's in here, or can I find it in here? Somebody opens a newspaper. Well, what's in the news today? So, in introduction, I'm saying here, questions are so basic and so important. It has to do with curiosity, with the sense of wonder, with a sense of aliveness, with a sense of interaction. We must handle material in order for it to become part of us. We've got to do something with it. Something has to happen. If you pour two chemicals together and they just sit there, well, they didn't really integrate, nothing happened. If you just pour something in the head, put some information in, and nothing happens with it, it doesn't really become a part of us. They tell us that your digestive tract, food in your digestive tract, really isn't part of you. It's simply any more than it is if you just hold it inside your mouth. It's got to be digested. It's got to be assimilated to actually become part of the body. Only then does it become part of you. And so the same thing is true as we read and as we study. Somehow the student must take a hold of that material and handle it, work it, if you will, in order for it to become part of him. He has to see what it's for and how it fits. In 1 John, he has a curious expression that says, that which we have heard, which we have seen, with our eyes, which we have looked upon, and our hands have handled, he said, the word of life. He's talking about Christ there and the word that he gave. We've heard it, we've seen it with our eyes, we've looked upon it, and our hands have handled it. And so our whole goal is to have the students come in here and take this material that they're learning, that they're reading, and pick it up and handle it, knead it, if you will, and make it a part of themselves and understand and think about it. And so I have a list here of some purposes of questioning. Why question? We might say, well, the students should ask the questions because, after all, they're the ones who are to learn, and the teachers are to teach, so they should answer the questions. And so that would be simple enough. You could start school on Monday morning. Teacher could come up front. Students come in, and they spend the day asking the teacher questions. Teacher answers them. Well, if that would in fact happen, why, that would be a fascinating day, wouldn't it? Actually, though, it's harder to ask a question than it is to answer it, isn't it, in many cases? Why is that? Well, you can't ask a good question if you don't know a certain amount about the material. You've got to know. You've got to know requires what they call metacognition. You've got to know what you know, and you've got to realize that there's something else out here that you don't know, and there's something about that that you don't know. And then you've got to be able to ask someone how you can fit that to what you know. Now, if you're able to actually ask that question, you may very well be able to answer it. You've all had the experience that you've taught of having a student come to you with a question. And they lay the book down, and they phrase the question. And about the time they get that question out, clearly, they say, oh, I see now. Who's ever had an experience like that? I see now. Now I know. Well, what was the whole question? Well, it required verbalizing that thing. If they can ask you the question properly, they oftentimes that's what all it takes to see through it. Not always, but that's a big part of it. And so, yes, it's good for students to ask questions, but we need to ask questions too. Questions can, the first one here says, can involve the students actively and verbally, giving them opportunity for expression and reaction. Answering a question really gives you the opportunity to learn more. The object of learning isn't just to take something in, but it's to interact with it, to work with it, to make it a part of you, to see how it fits. And so to be able to use it the next day, if you learn something in math, you're going to have to use that skill that you learned today, tomorrow, and the next day. It's assumed that next week, when we do the new material that calls for, we're going to have to include in solving that problem what we learned today. So we've got to be able to use that. Same thing in history. As we go along through the year, why, we need to understand some things that happened back here in order to make sense out of things that happened up here. And so there is a building, there is a fit. Obviously, it helps us to evaluate the level of understanding. This is especially true if you're helping individuals. If you have an individual student, if he's working on his own, and he raises the hand, puts up the flag, and you come around to answer his question. Why, the first thing you have to determine is, really, what's he asking? What does he understand and what doesn't he understand? This is really gets to the heart of teaching. The teacher is not just one who, in fact, he's primarily not one who knows. There are many people who know but cannot teach. You'll especially see that if you go on a field trip and have a guide show you around. I've had guys take us around who proceeded to talk to the teacher. I've had them actually address me already, explaining things. Not even aware that the children are there almost. Well, that's all right. They're not teachers. But the teacher is the one who can see what it is that the child understands and what it is that he doesn't understand and what he has to understand in order to answer this question, and then know how to get him to the point that he understands. Now, it may require giving him some information. It may require challenging him. It may require backing up and having him tell you what he does know about something. But somehow something has to happen up here. You cannot simply give a child an answer and move on any more than you can take a butterfly out of its cocoon. They say the old story is if you remove the cocoon, the butterfly will die because he has to have the experience of struggling in there to pump up his wings. And if you simply remove him, he'll never be able to fly. And that's so true with students. When the flag goes up and you go to answer the question, or the hand goes up and you go to answer the individual question, breathe a little prayer for wisdom there, that you know how to answer that in such a way that you encourage him, that he's glad he asked for help, and yet not in such a way that you stop further thinking. He shouldn't just, fill in the blank and move on. But it should be answered in such a way that he's glad he asked. And he should be challenged a bit that together with the teacher helping me and my thinking, we can get this answered and move on. Without a little stretch, without some effort, there's no learning. The child's got to do something himself. So when we answer questions, we're helping them to struggle through it. We're not doing the thinking for them. Thirdly, questions help fix facts in the mind. It's a very common purpose for questions, and there is some value in that. The person simply recalling, reviewing, reiterating, it helps you if you say something over, if you review it, it helps you to remember it better. It also helps you sometimes to look at things from a different perspective if you review something later. And also, questioning, asking and answering questions can be a group activity. You can raise the question, and the students then can think together. And as the question's answered, why the group, in a sense, thinks together. If it's a group activity, why everyone's mind is dealing with the same question at the same time. It gives the group thinks together. It's their class. Sometimes it actually can be used to secure information. Don't pass up those opportunities. In a class, oftentimes if a teacher asks the question, he knows the answer. And the question is asked as a learning exercise for the students to think or to see if they remember. But sometimes there's something you really don't know. And a student may be sitting close to the Information Please Almanac. Somebody may have a dictionary on the desk. And you can simply ask that person, would you look that up while we go on, and have him actually look it up right there while you maybe go on with another comment or two or an illustration, and then give him time to look it up. And then he can tell us the fact it is that came up that we didn't know the answer to, the population of this country or whatever. And the value of that, of course, it gives the information on the subject at the time, and it also shows the students that, if you don't know something, well, look it up. Look it up right now. That's what books are for. That's why we have almanacs. That's why we have dictionaries. We actually use them. I use them, and you can use them. It's no big deal. Just take it. Look it up. Some students, we may take it for granted that you use reference books, but some students may never use reference books other than a specific school assignment unless they actually see it happen sometimes like that spontaneously. Use questions to introduce a story, perhaps. It gives focus. Maybe you have a story about coming up in a reading book, and you can ask a question like, what good jobs could you still hold if you were seen to be a total failure in school? If someone didn't get along very well academically, what would be some good jobs that you could hold and do very well on? And you could stimulate them to think a bit and say, no, Read the story for tomorrow, and you're going to find out a person who had an experience like that. Introduce a story or a lesson, or follow up a story or a lesson. Now that we've read the story, how important is responsibility as compared to ability? Which is more important? Which do you think an employer would rather see? A person who's very responsible or a person who's very able? And you could use that as a follow-up question, as a discussion. And notice that a question like that does not have just a quick, pat answer, but it can stimulate thinking, and the student may in fact go on over the next days or weeks thinking about, oh, yes, responsibility versus ability. And you might even touch on that another time or two in the next days. Another purpose of questioning is to check comprehension as the material is actually read together. If you're reading through a text together on occasion, if you're reading through a story, or perhaps you're doing some taking turns reading in some other text, you can actually help teach children how to read by the kind of questions that you ask. When a paragraph has been read, or two paragraphs have been read, you can stop and ask a question. Now, what do you think the character is planning to do next? Some students really, they know that. Some students know that other students read books and get out of them what they don't get out of. They like to read, and they seem to understand things I don't understand, but I don't know what they do. I don't really like reading. Well, if you stop and ask some questions between paragraphs, you can actually, these students who don't seem to get much from a book when they read it, can see that, oh, well, based on what was read in this last paragraph, it's possible to think these kinds of thoughts. It's possible to think about that person's motives just from what that last paragraph said. Oh, I didn't think about it that you could think like that after just reading one paragraph. I thought that what you do when you finish with one paragraph is read the next one. And so the point is that you can, in a sense, pattern or demonstrate. Let them see what a reader can do, what a good reader does, by the kinds of questions, the kinds of questions that you can ask. And now you don't want to overdo it and get the reading too labored, but demonstrate how you can think between as you read. Another possibility is to require the answerer to take a stand or express an opinion. There are those people who will always say, well, I don't know, it's all right with me, whatever. And they don't want to be called in the carpet for anything. I don't want to have to be committed to anything, just whatever. Well, sometimes, depending on what you've read or what the story is, you can require someone, what do you think he should have done in this situation? Well, maybe he should have done. Why? Why? Why should he have done that? You have a reason for that. Well, I don't, well, you come up with one. You can require people sometimes to express an opinion. Is it good to do this? And teach them to think. I'm not saying they should make them opinionated, but we have to be able to take some stands sometimes. We can clarify situations. What was, for example, in the case where the Pharisees came to Jesus numerous times and asked him questions, and what were they really trying to achieve? Did they really want to know what to do with this adulteress? Did they really want to know whether they could? What was really their motive? And so sometimes we can ask a question that will clarify the motives or the situation. Questions can create interest, involve everybody. By asking questions, we can involve the students. Sometimes if you see attention wandering a bit, of course, you can direct a question here or a question there, although that shouldn't be your primary goal in asking questions, to keep the class paying attention. If the class is such that the group, no one's paying attention, well, then there's another problem. But it's interesting to, you can tailor your questions to the students, too. And you can see who has attention or not. I had a fascinating experience just yesterday. I asked a question And see, do you name the student before you ask the question, or do you ask the question first and then name the student? Laverne, what do you think you should do?
Ask the question.
And why would you normally do that? Right. If I say Jason, and then proceed to ask the question, the rest of you can get on with your doodling and can do something else, get your daydream up to date, because you know you're off the hook until Jason and I are finished with our little exchange. But if I ask the question first, well, you really don't know who's, you're all supposed to hear, you're all supposed to think, and then I call on one person to answer. Now, I asked, a question. I don't remember what the question was. That's really irrelevant. But I asked the question first, and then I looked back and saw this girl sitting there with a little bit of a vacuous expression on her face. And I said her name, and I could see that the wheels turning. And now she was a rather capable student, and I realized what happened first was that she was not paying close attention, but she had that question in her fuzzy short-term memory, and what she did was reach back there and quickly grasped that. It was almost gone, but not quite. She had to first get what the question was. She kind of pulled it back as it floated away and pulled it back and got the question and then answered it, and it was all right. And I smiled a bit, and I commented on that. I said, I find that interesting. I said, because tomorrow I'm supposed to have actually a talk on asking and answering questions. And she was a person who could field that kind of question. She actually explained what happened there. Was, I had to first think what the question was. Now, some students will just say, well, what was the question? Sometimes you may ask a question and it may seem that half the people don't hear you. Half of them are on with the daydreams. And you ask someone's name, and you need to repeat the question anyway. But still, you generally want to ask the question first and then call for the answer. Anyway, it involves the group. It also helps to improve the memory. Now let's get on to some types of questions. There are rhetorical questions that have some place in the classroom. But the rhetorical question is one that you ask where you don't really expect anybody to answer out loud. And it's simply, in a sense, a rhetorical tool. Have you ever seen a falling star? You might not actually expect them to respond, but then you use that as an application. If you have, why, then you know that it, whatever, moves very fast. Now, the comment I have to make about rhetorical questions is don't overuse them. Don't overuse them. If you ask a rhetorical question, be sure that you intend it to be a rhetorical question. If you really expect somebody to answer, why then have somebody answer? When you throw out the question and nobody answers, and you don't call on anybody, you really train your students not to listen to your questions. This would especially be true at the end of a class if you give the assignment, what they're supposed to do for tomorrow, and you say, does anybody have any questions? And nobody ever does, and you never call anybody either, and this goes on. And what can easily happen is that there are certain times at the beginning of a class or the end of a class that you say the same thing every day. Everybody knows that you say the same thing every day, and nobody thinks. It really is useless. They know that when you get to this certain point in the class, there's certain words that you're going to always say, and they could just tune you out because it's really purposeless. And if somebody would raise his hand, everybody would almost be surprised if he did. If you have this little pattern that you go through, that you ask a question but really don't expect anybody to answer, and it happens every day, you might just as well say words, 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 or something else. It's really kind of a pointless exercise. So I'm saying beware of purposeless expressions that you say every day if they don't really serve a purpose. If the question is not a rhetorical question, call on somebody, get an answer. Application questions. May we take someone's supplies if we're starving? They're hypothetical questions, perhaps. But how do you apply things? How would you do this? How would you get yourself over a fence if you had just a rope and a bucket to stand on, or whatever? An application question. Somehow, how would you apply this? A leading question is one where you put the words in the person's mouth. You lead him all over the answer. I tell students sometimes now, would you rather have a test or would you rather have a recognition exercise? Now, of course, they like to call them all tests. But I tell them now, what we call a matching test is, in a sense, not really a test, because here you have some information, over here you have the answers, and all you have to do is recognize it. And we all know how it is if you meet somebody and you say, no, I met you before somewhere, but I just can't get the first name. But if you'd say it, I'd know it. And they say, John, that's right. John, I know I heard that before. Well, did you know the person's name or didn't you? Well, it was back there somewhere. And when you heard it, then you could, oh, yes, I heard that before. Well, that's the way some tests are in a matching exercise. You have this and you go, now, if I see the right thing, I think I'll, yes, there it is. Well, did you know it or didn't you? You know it if it's given to you. But if it's not given to you, you don't. Now, I'm not saying don't use matching tests. They're easy to make and they're fast to make. However, remember that there's a difference. It's really a different kind of question. It's, in a sense, it's kind of a leading question. A leading question leads the person right over the answer, right over the answer, right over the familiar territory. All he has to do is recognize, oh, yes, yes, that's right. And all he has to do is recognize or acknowledge it. You could say, for example, when Satan tempted Eve to eat the apple and said that she wouldn't really die when she ate the apple, that was a lie, wasn't it? Well, it's not too hard to recognize that and say, yes, yeah, that was a lie. But then to simply ask, what was really going on when Satan tempted Eve, or what did he do when he tempted Eve? That's a different kind of question. Leading questions have a place, and sometimes a child who doesn't volunteer answers so often, or isn't so quick to answer questions, will answer a leading question more quickly. Practical questions are somewhat like application ones. How do we find this information? How could we do it? A comprehension question. Simply, who came? Straight comprehension, recall, or there's also more difficult comprehension questions. Recall questions do have a place. Quick recall questions are very useful in a sense, laying out the facts. If we're going to discuss a history lesson that we've read or a science lesson, we can't really discuss it, we can't really think about it unless we know that we have the information, the cards out on the table, so to speak, unless we have the information available. So we need to know whether the students read the lesson or whether they understand it. So some quick recall questions can help us to find out whether they actually know the facts that we're going to be using in our discussion or that are coming up on the test. So recall questions do have a place. When did the Roman Empire fall? Some dates. Who was involved here? Who are the characters in the story? What happened? Where did they live? What happened first, second, third? And then once we know that they know the story, then we can get on with some other kinds of questions. The inferential question is the one that's, we say, reading between the lines. Is that person angry? We can compare things. What's really driving him? Evaluative question is one that judges. Is this worthy? Was that effective? Was that proper? Was that convincing? Was it logical? It requires the individual, the student, to, based on his own experience or his own person, his own beliefs or whatever, it requires him to evaluate and say, yes, that was good, or no, it wasn't. Yes, it's convincing. It was effective. It was proper. It was worthwhile, whatever. Personal questions would be a question that actually you're going to give an answer to based on who you are and what experiences you've had. Has anyone been to Niagara Falls? Maybe you're reading about something in geography. Well, depending if someone's been there, he can answer questions in a way that nobody else can. And so sometimes those questions can be very interesting because someone, because of his who he is, because of his experience, he can answer something or bring some light on something that nobody else in the room can because of where he's been. Or another kind of personal question could be, what would you do in a situation like this? Or what do you like to do with your spare time? Something that applies to him as an individual. Well, stimulating questions are quite varied, but the kind of thing that is open-ended, and for example, what would happen if we had no teacher for a day? Suppose some morning you all came and teachers just simply didn't show up. What do you suppose the day would be like? Well, that should be a hypothetical question, I guess, too. Here's one I remember discussing with in Bible class already with ethics. Can you think of a situation in which it would be wrong to arrive at church on time? Can you think of a situation in which it would be wrong to arrive? Well, it's always right to be at church in time, isn't it? And you connect that a little to the story of the Good Samaritan, and imagine that you're driving to church and are witness to an accident or see someone struck. Somehow someone injured. Now, which comes first? Helping someone or being, I've got to be there at 9 o'clock? How would you feel when you walk in on time? There are many kinds of, all different types of stimulating questions that make someone think, oh, yeah, I never thought about that. Then there are questions adapted to the individual. That's actually a bit like the personal question. But let me expand that a bit. When I say adapted to the individual, you draw upon the individual's abilities or individual experience. Children have different abilities to answer questions, different levels of comprehension. And you do want to challenge them. You want to draw them out. And so the student who loves the challenge of a heavy thought, you should challenge him sometimes with a hard question. There might be another student in the room. If you ask him the same kind of question, he would feel lost, perhaps. Now, you can rephrase a question sometimes. Suppose you started out, for example, if you have a really capable student, really capable, who likes hard questions, why you start the class the next day, maybe they had an assignment to read for history. Say, all right, Roger, what's the most significant thing you learned in the lesson that we assigned for today? Now, that's a very hard question. It's a rare student who would respond to a question, what's the most significant thing you learned? Who would respond? Most people, did I learn anything? That requires you not only be able to state some things that you learn, it also requires you to see that there is significance in something that you learn. Then it requires you to separate those and pick out the most significant thing. That would be generally a useless question to start a class with. You don't think that's a hard... And yet, when children go home from school, parents often ask, what did you learn in school today? That's not an easy question to answer. It's much better to ask, what did you read or what did you talk about? And if you don't think that's a hard question, just ask one of your friends on Sunday when you get home from church, what did you learn in church this morning? Now, you should be able to answer that, but it's not easy. And so you can ask, that would be a hard question. What did you learn in the lesson for today? Well, another level of question would be, what did you read about for today? Or tell me two things you read about in the assignment for today. That gets more specific. That's easier to answer. Maybe it was a lesson on geography. I have this based on a little lesson on geography from India. You could ask, what's meant by sati? That's the widow burning that the Indians used to practice. What's meant by that? Well, if a person can answer that question, you know that he read his lesson, and he also understands that term, unless he knew it from before. Or you could ask, a question, or most Indians Christian, that requires a yes or no answer. So the kind of question you ask can require quite a variety of levels of thinking called for, and quite a difference in difficulty in answering, whether it's just a yes or no. Now, you don't want to make your questions too simple. You're going to insult the students, and if they don't raise their hands, they might all be feeling, well, we all know the answer, and it's pointless for anyone else to offer, because we all know that. So be aware of making it too simple. And also, if you ask a question and then you rephrase it to make it easier, be careful that the student doesn't get too uptight. What I mean by that is, if I ask a question and you're not sure about the answer, I have two possibilities. I can rephrase that and make it easier to answer, or I can just move to somebody else and ask the same question. Now, you can do either one. But if I rephrase it and make it easier, and you answer the question, you'll feel fine about it, and we'll move on. But if you still can't answer it, now what? Well, I might rephrase that again and make it simpler yet. But eventually, if I do this often enough, you're going to start feeling uptight about this. I mean, after all, you've been making this easier and easier. And the student may feel better in giving a wrong answer to a good question than getting it so simple that it's very obvious that anybody knows the answer. All right, brief questions have a place. Very quick questions. Who won? Questions, that's one value of yes-no questions, especially to start a class. You can very quickly cover some material. Oblique or hidden questions. Something like, really, what did David do when he ate the showbread, or Jesus when he and his disciples ate the corn? Well, an obvious answer might be that they broke a law, but did they really? Did they really? Sometimes there's a question hidden in a question, and the person might see that, well, on the face of it, it looks like you're asking this, but actually I see another question behind that. And the spontaneous question is one that, just as it occurs, you think on your feet, you ask questions as they occur. You really didn't plan to ask them beforehand. And then the discovery or the analysis question. Now, how did I do that? Or how could we solve this problem? Or what did you do? How did you get that answer? A student who has a wrong answer in math, you might want him to back up and see how he thought, how he arrived at that conclusion, in order to think through so he doesn't make the same mistake again. How do we know that the furnace that Daniel's friends walked in, how do we know that that was quite a large furnace? How could you tell that? Well, it was big enough for four men to walk around inside. So there are questions that require some more than just obvious answers. Going to the third section on manner and techniques on the backside. As you ask questions, we want to be earnest and sincere, not overbearing or condescending. We care about the students. We don't want to give a pompous attitude, I know all the answers, or that we're talking down to them. But be earnest. In a sense, you want to try to feel on the level that you're working with your children on, whatever grade level that is. Going to number three, sometimes you may want to plan ahead, learn what can be put in question form. I'm not suggesting to write out the questions, but as you think of the topic for the next lesson, give some thought to kinds of things that you can ask about. Sometimes give the students questions ahead of time in order to guide their thinking and say, tomorrow we want to discuss this question or this problem. Have them come to class with some thought on it. Sometimes a theme question can give a purpose to the whole class. For example, As we conclude our study on the country of India or Bangladesh, let's discuss what do we think is the cause of their poverty? What's the root of poverty in Bangladesh? That's a big question. And I'm not sure whether we can know the answer on this side of the ocean if we've not been there, but we could still talk about it in some valid ways and use the information that we have read about to discuss the question. So sometimes one good question is all it takes to give direction, to give a theme to a whole class session. Ask spontaneous questions along a particular theme or for a particular purpose throughout the class. Use them to generate discussion. Number 5, direct to the whole class first, give everybody an opportunity to think. Another one is to allow several answers sometimes before responding. And sometimes, especially, some questions do not have a definite answer. And rather than asking a student to answer a question, he answers it, well, that's the answer to that, now we go on. You answer it. What do you have to say? That's interesting. Good. What do you have to say? And what do you think? You may find that they may agree very closely. They may look at things from a different perspective. They may simply word it in different ways. That shows that not all questions have simply a direct pat answer. For example, a discussion one, especially if you're talking about the problems of refugees or the causes of poverty, like I alluded to before. There are quite a few different ways of getting at the answers. So allow several people to respond before you respond. And of course, number 6, be sure they understand the question. Sometimes if you ask a question and a student answers, but doesn't answer correctly, you can sense that he misunderstood the question. And you can tell him that what you gave is the correct answer to this question. And you can state what he gave the correct answer to. But what I really wanted to ask was, and then you can answer a question again. And sometimes we make a mistake in asking the question. Sometimes we intend to ask a question, but word it in such a way that we actually come through asking something different. So be sure they understand the question. And be sure, think about when they answer, they might have answered something different from what you thought you asked. There's a little saying that says something like that, that what you think you said might not be what they understood you to say. Never allow a student to feel embarrassed or inferior by any honest question he asks or answer he gives. Never allow him or the class to cause him to feel embarrassed or inferior. I like to tell my students, We're in school. This is the place to learn. This is the place we're all very comfortable with each other. There is no such thing as a stupid answer. There is no such thing as a stupid question. If you're not sure, you ask. It's safe to ask if you don't know. Doesn't matter how often it was asked before. If you don't understand, ask. We don't laugh at the questions we ask. You want to feel secure that you can ask. And you can suggest an answer to something. Now, if a student answers something and it's wrong, sometimes we can find something in that answer that applies. We can say, well, that's partly true, or that might work in this case, but we can somehow use some of that information, and a student can feel that his response is useful, it's helpful, but it's not complete, and so we go on and ask other people to help answer. Maybe you can show why the answer is wrong and perhaps point out what kind of thinking leads to that kind of answer, but that really doesn't work out. Fit your answers to the motive of the student's questions. Discourage needless questions. And so sometimes a sincere question should have an honest answer. If a student asks a question simply to consume time, you can redirect that and say, well, ask me that at break time or at recess time. Not every question deserves an answer. If they want to know where they're going on the year-end trip in the middle of math class, well, that's not the time for that question. So I'm not saying that you honestly take every question and let them consume time. You can see through that. So if the question's irrelevant, or you can redirect, you can simply pass it off and say, we don't have time to talk about that now, or that doesn't really apply now. Let's move on with this. And sometimes you can assign a student to ask questions the next class. You may want to say, read your lesson for tomorrow. I want you each to have one question to ask the class. Maybe something you don't understand, something you wonder about, a question to raise to the class. Or if you like a challenge yourself, tell them, tomorrow we're going to start the class. I want each of you to ask me one question, and I'll see how well I can answer them without looking in the book. The next day when you start the class, you already know how that will start. All right. Time for your questions. You read the lesson? Ask me something. You don't pretend you're going to know all the answers, but they have the opportunity to ask you a question. Remember, they may have some fun out of this, but it's harder to ask questions than it is to answer them in a way. So if they're going to ask you good questions based on the lesson, they're going to have to do a little digging to find something to ask. And if they can stump you, fine. They did some digging to do that. So encourage them to ask questions. Beware of questions that have no challenge. I already talked about rhetorical questions. And 13, if a student asks for help, have him explain to you as you prompt him with questions how he thought, arrive where he is now, and where he's stuck. Oftentimes, you will help him to see through his problem as you do that. A general observation. And one other thing I want to say yet is be sure to allow students think time in answering a question. I'm not sure how much time you think a student should have to answer a question. It depends on the kind of question. If they're supposed to have a lesson read and you're simply asking some recall questions, who's the main character? And where did he go? What happened? Well, they should be able to answer the questions like that. But if you're requiring any thought at all, you've got to require them some time to think. If they're supposed to give an opinion, if they're supposed to say what they think about something, say whether this was proper, if they're supposed to give a suggestion of how this problem could be solved, if they're supposed to think about what the causes might be of this person's action, you should allow at least several seconds, shouldn't you? Now, it's amazing how long time can be. But let's suppose that I ask you something like, what do you think one of the causes might be for for poverty in Bangladesh? What might one of the causes be? Now, I'm going to give you 5 seconds, and after I ask the question, I'll give you 5 seconds, and you see how short or how long you think that time is. What do you think one of the causes might be for poverty in Bangladesh? Bill? Now, that's not very much time, is it? And yet, in a sense, it is. Many of the questions we ask don't require a whole lot of think time, but some do. My point is, if you expect students to think, they shouldn't be afraid of some silence. They should feel comfortable with that. They should know, though, that if you ask a question and it's silent, you're expecting them to think, not just wait until the teacher starts talking again. Now, of course, that's a $100 question there itself. How do you get them to think? Well, ask a good question. Ask a good question. But allow them enough time to think. If you don't allow time to think when you ask a good question, you're saying a couple things. For one thing, you're saying that I expect you to give glib answers to heavy questions, and that's not good. You don't want the person to just answer off the top of his head. And on the other hand, if you don't give them time to think, you're really not respecting the difficulty of what it takes to answer a hard question. So allow appropriate time for the kind of question it is. In closing, some general observations. Study Jesus' questions and answers. And also consider having the students ask questions too. And my last comment would be sure that when you ask a question, be sure that when you answer a student's question, you haven't answered all his questions. When you answer a question, it should be answered in such a way that the student finds satisfaction in the answer that you give him. But on the other hand, at the same time, it should stimulate him to further thinking and to pursue his work. The answer to a question should not bring a stop to thinking, but rather it should stimulate more thinking. Now, I'm not saying that you should always raise questions and have people live with unanswered questions. I'm not suggesting that. That can be carried too far. But answer in such a way that the student is glad he asked. He shouldn't feel that the teacher will never answer me. But on the other hand, he should also know that the teacher won't just give me the blank to fill in, but I'll have to do some thinking myself. And so curiosity is very important in learning. And really, as you think about it yourself, do you learn anything without having some questions in your mind? As you have fellowship this evening, as you visit with your friends, well, there'll be, I don't know how many hundreds of questions will be asked to each other as we continue our fellowship here. But answering questions is very fascinating, very stimulating, and is very much at the heart of reading and learning. Let's have a word of prayer before we close. Father, we thank you for this lovely day. We thank you for the privilege we had of sitting together these hours this far. We thank you, Jesus, that you came here and taught us, that you asked and answered questions. And we thank you that you give us answers that we can live with, and you also stimulate us to go on learning and growing. Help us to live with that sense of wonder that provides the spark in our life and motivates us to serve you. Help us as we work with our students to stimulate them to continue to learn and to enjoy growing day by day. We thank you and pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. You're dismissed.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.